A visit with poet Richard Wilbur.
One of the functions of poetry is to make our terrors clear and so disarm them a little.
We spend the hour today with Wilbur in his book-filled writing studio, talking with him about his 80-year career as a poet. Richard Wilbur is one of America's greatest living poets. He earned the Pulitzer Prize for poetry twice, once in 1957 and then in 1989. That gives you an idea of the long span of his life as a poet. He actually published his first poem at the age of 8, and he's been a regular contributor of poetry to The New Yorker for many years. Wilbur's poems are honed to a deceptive simplicity. As one reviewer said, all of them are easy to read while being suffused with an astonishing verbal music and a compacted thoughtfulness that invites sustained reflection. Wilbur's work is informed by a celebratory timbre of the world and of the individuals within it. The poet Randall Jarrell said that he was always reminded of Petronius's phrase, studied felicity, whenever he read a book of Wilbur's. But before we get to our interview with Wilbur, I'd like to play an excerpt from an interview I did with Jean Bram in 2007 about her book Light Within the Light. In it, she writes about four New England poets, one of whom is Richard Wilbur. She titles a chapter about him, A Difficult Balance. I asked her why.
I think it was by the time Richard Wilbur was 32 that he had won all of the major prizes save the Pulitzer. I don't think he won that till he was 35. He just had an extraordinary meteoric rise to the heights most people work for by the time they're 70 in poetry. And then he had the misfortune to fall out of fashion. The mid-1970s through about the mid-1980s, I think, saw the rise of the confessional school of poetry. And, as a matter of fact, Anne Sexton was one of the major movers and shakers in that highly subjective, well, it is just what it says, I will confess the pain of my life, and I will spill it on the page. And, of course, Wilbur's work has always been going in just the opposite direction, which is not to say there isn't pain in the work, but it is beautifully balanced with what there is in life to affirm. And it is suspended in a wonderfully symmetrical, intricate, stanzaic forms. So for about a 10-year period, his verse really fell out of favor. And when literary critics would talk about the Redskins in American literature and the pale faces, invariably he was a pale face.
Or when they'd what do you mean by that? Redskins and pale faces?
Well, they meant the gutsy, spermy, blood on the page school of poetry, as opposed to the Apollonian, balanced, affirming kind of poetry and poet that Wilbur has always represented.
Writer Jean Bram. We at Writer's Voice are lucky that Wilbur lives so close to where we produce the show. It's a pleasant country drive out to his home in the foothills of the Berkshires and the small rural town of Cummington, Massachusetts. Guest co-host Christian McEwen and I drove out there in June. Richard Wilbur, I want to just thank you so much for inviting us into your lovely writing domain. You know, when I first called you up and asked you if you would consent to talk with me and now us about your poems, I got the distinct sense that you really wanted to talk about your latest poems, the ones that have been published in The New Yorker over the last few years. So I think I'd like to just dive in with the latest and ask you, do you see, first of all, some changes, some differences in your latest poetry from some of your earlier work?
I can't say whether there's any difference of a stylistic nature. Probably the process of becoming opener and opener, which happened in my many years of writing poems, has gone on. And one of my recent subjects, as anybody can tell, is the loss of my beloved wife, who was a great encourager of my poetry, and to whom I address quite a few words of verse still. Another thing that's happened in recent years, I don't know exactly how to explain this, is that I've taken to writing in haiku stanzas, rhyming the first and third line of each stanza. It turns out to be a very agreeable way to talk for my present inclinations.
You said that over the years of being a poet that you have become more and more open. I wonder if you could tell us more about what do you mean? What is the process of becoming more open as a poet? What does that mean?
Well, I think I can put it pretty plainly. When I began to concern myself a lot with poetry, and perhaps to write my earliest efforts, I think that I was strongly impressed by the new critics of the early part of the 20th century, and therefore felt that a poem ought to be a full account of one's consciousness in the most self-contradictory way possible. My poems were full of ironies and other modes of differing from myself. And they were as psychologically complex as I could make them be. And then I found myself from 1950 onward getting mixed up in the translation of plays for the theater. And if you do that fortunately and wholeheartedly, as I did, you find that there's some transference from the translation of drama to the technique of one's own poems. I found that my poems came to be more and more straightforward utterances of some one mood of mine. One of my various selves was given its head. And I do think that that has pretty well gone on. Irony and self-contradiction have not vanished from my poetry, but it's not as conspicuous, I think, as it was in my early efforts.
So basically what you're talking about then is a kind of progressive simplification, that openness and simplicity, not in a way of saying that things are less profound by any means, but in that stripping away of complexity as one gains in one's craft. Is that right?
Well, I think I'm saying that I've simply become more dramatic, and that I give some aspect of my experience its head more than I was inclined to do in my early days. I don't know how true an account this is of the development of my writing, but that's the way I feel it.
And could you give an example of one of your latest... Do you have some of your latest poems here? Can you read some of them?
Yes.
Because that would be wonderful, yeah.
Well, here's a fairly recent poem of mine that came out in the New Yorker, and it's like a lot of my poems in the past, in the sense that I always try to get the nature right. I remember an amusing attack on various poets like Dylan Thomas by Jeffrey Grigson, in which he pointed out to them that there is no such thing as a grave worm, and that if you're going to write about natural things, you ought to look them up in a book or know them as a countryman knows things. Well, this is the nature in this is to be trusted, whatever else. It's called A Measuring Worm. This yellow-striped green caterpillar climbing up the steep window screen, constantly, for lack of a full set of legs, keeps humping up his back. It's as if he's sent by a sort of semaphore, dark omegas meant to warn of last things. Although he doesn't know it, he will soon have wings. And I too don't know toward what undreamt condition, inch by inch, I go. Well, that's the sort of poem you write when you're getting to be 88 years old, and there's more than a little sense of mortality in this poem, though it's taken lightly.
Yes, and that note of lightness, as well as, I mean, it is a kind of a chiaroscuro there, in a way, because there's the lightness of the little, the inchworm and the measuring worm, as well as that sense of mortality. Christian and I were talking before we came up here about your use of nature in the poetry, and I'd like to turn the mic over to her because we had some reflections on how that is incorporated in your work.
I wanted to ask you, because I heard recently that the Oxford Junior Dictionary was dropping a whole crowd of nature-related words from its children's edition. I don't know if you knew this.
No, I haven't heard.
It was very shocking to me. They were taking away words like wren and heron, and even very children's words like goldfish and gerbil and hamster, and they were replacing them with computer words like chat room and BlackBerry in the new sense, and blog, and there was actually been a protest about it. And when I was I just had heard this when I was reading your poems preparatory to coming here, and I remembered an old came across an old poem of yours called "Advice to a Prophet," in which you say, "What should we be without the dolphin's ark, the dove's return, these things in which we have seen ourselves and spoken?" So I was wondering what you would make of this fact, of these powerful, I mean, the Oxford edition of things for the children is important, and they're taking away and trashing, essentially, all these very important nature-related words.
Well, I'm appalled to hear that. It seems to me that every child should see a heron and know what he or she is looking at. I was brought up on somebody else's farm with a lot of country and a lot of animals and a lot of trees, the names of which I knew. And it seemed to me a happy and normal childhood. And I'm distressed that these lexicographers have a notion that children can grow up without a continual knowing contact with the environment. It's a shocking notion. Now that I think of it, a physical therapist whom I know was saying to me the other day that her children spend very much less time out of doors than she and her contemporaries used to do, that it's hard to get them away from their dreadful little machines.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with poet Richard Wilbur about some of his new poems and also his life as a poet. I asked Richard Wilbur to read the poem "Advice to a Prophet." I'd found it in my collection of 100 Greatest Poems of the 20th Century, edited by fellow poet laureate Mark Strand.
And right over there, that picture of the night sky was sent me by Mark Strand, so I'm on good terms with him. Well, this poem, "Advice to a Prophet," which you kindly request, was written after a long period of trying to be adequate to the subject of the nuclear threat. When I read this to an audience, I often remember that I was on leave from the ETO in England when we dropped the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And a fellow soldier said to me, I'll give you $10 if you can write a poem about that by the weekend. And I told him to keep his money. It took me until 1959, finally, to measure up to what, after all, is a big fact in our lives and has to be written about. Well, I'll read it with no further ado. Advice to a prophet. When you come, as you soon must, to the streets of our city, mad-eyed from stating the obvious, not proclaiming our fall, but begging us in God's name to have self-pity, spare us all word of the weapons, their force and range, the long numbers that rocket the mind. Our slow, unreckoning hearts will be left behind, unable to fear what is too strange. Nor shall you scare us with talk of the death of the race. How should we dream of this place without us? The sun, mere fire, the leaves untroubled about us, a stone look on the stone's face. Speak of the world's own change. Though we cannot conceive of an undreamt thing, we know to our cost how the dreamt cloud crumbles, the vines are blackened by frost, how the view alters. We could believe, if you told us so, that the white-tailed deer will slip into perfect shade, grown perfectly shy. The lark avoid the reaches of our eye. The jackpine lose its knuckled grip on the cold ledge, and every torrent burn as Xanthus once, its gliding trout stunned in a twinkling. What should we be without the dolphin's ark, the dove's return, these things in which we have seen ourselves and spoken? Ask us, prophet, how we shall call our natures forth when that lie of tongue is all dispelled, that glass obscured or broken, in which we have said the rose of our love and the clean horse of our courage, in which beheld the singing locust of the soul unshelled, and all we mean or wish to mean. Ask us whether with the wordless rose our hearts shall fail us. Come demanding whether there shall be lofty or long standing when the bronze annals of the oak tree close.
You read that, it's an elegy, really, in the tone and the sense of the poem. And I think, you know, we haven't really progressed much since those days. Maybe we think less of the nuclear holocaust and we think more of the planet dying through climate change. But so much of your poetry is really infused with a great sense of joy. And you have said... you have in the Paris Review interviews, you said that the ultimate character of things is comely and good. How do you put this together with your enduring optimism, it seems, that comes in your poetry, the celebration that's in your poetry? Maybe optimism is not the right word.
Well, the world does seem to me wondrously made, or perhaps I should just say wondrous. And I've never ceased to respond to it, its beauty and fascination, whatever else there may be to bewail. And another thing about positiveness in poetry, I do think, in my case, it's simply constitutional. I am inclined, as my friend Randall Jarrell said, to see the bright underside of every dark thing.
You've just gone through a great loss.
Yes.
And I was reading your biography and talking with Christian on the way up here. I was saying, wow, it just seems like Richard Wilbur has lived a very charmed life. Of course, that's looking at it from the outside. But you were together with your wife since you were kids, basically.
Well, yes. She was, I guess, a sophomore at Smith when I met her. And we were together as man and wife for 64 years. And I feel very lucky about that, which is not to say that I cheerfully accept her absence. But in that respect, I've certainly had a very fortunate life. And I've had a fortunate life in finding what it was that I could do fairly well and what it was that could prove in one way or another useful to other people. All that's good. I could give you a list of dreadful things that have happened to me or to those I love, but on the whole, I vote yes.
I wonder if poetry has been a consolation for you also. You say you still write poems to your wife. Is that how I understood what you said?
Well, my wife was, from the very beginning, the great encourager of my poems, and she was the person to whom I showed them always. And the many translations I've done from 17th century French drama, I always checked with her first and checked with her line by line. Her French was better than mine anyway. And I still feel encouraged by her. And I feel as if I feel something like her approval as I sit down and try to write yet another poem. And thank heavens, the words do keep coming. I find, like anyone of 88 years old, that there are various words which elude me, especially names are getting away from me. But I still find enough of them, if I'm patient, to put some poems together.
Well, you mentioned your translations, and that's something else I wanted to ask you about. How do you approach translation? You've translated Molière and Racine, the plays of them, but also an awful lot of poetry from the French as well as others. And so talk a bit about what you struggle with in doing translation, how you find that voice, and what is your approach towards the voice?
Well, I think that the job of the translator, if he's just not fooling around, is to be utterly slavish, to manage to find an equivalent for all of the words that are in the original, at any rate all of the thoughts, and for the form of the original, and then above all for the tone of the original. I think that's where translations which are linguistically worthy often go wrong. And one reason I've translated just about everything of Molière's that was done in verse is that I came to feel that I was being true to him, that I was in tune with his sense of what was funny and also his sense of what people and the world generally were like. So for me, it's been a long exercise in fidelity, and I hope I haven't kidded myself.
We're talking today with Richard Wilbur, one of America's greatest living poets. I'm joined by co-host Christian McEwen on this interview.
I'm good friends with the translator and poet Alistair Reid. I've known him since I was a child, and I'm imagining you know his Neruda translations and so forth. I was wondering how translation has influenced your own poetry making and the conversation back and forth between translation and poetry.
I think translation has had an enormous effect on my own poetry. And reverting to something I was saying a few moments ago, the act of translation, especially as I was translating on the whole plays, has led me in the direction of being more dramatic, more open. I think that's been the chief effect of it.
I'd like to ask you something now about the form and the way you do poetry. I mean, you've gone against the tide of lots of late 20th century poetry, which was done in free verse. Mm-hmm. Yours has been more formal, and it rhymes. And, well, you knew Frost, you knew Robert Frost, and some have actually compared your work to Robert Frost. You've quoted him. He said, "Bad poets rhyme words, good poets rhyme phrases." Could you talk more about how the formal structure of the poetry, and you're recently now doing haiku, how does that structure be the container for your poetry?
I think of form as something which is not the final end of any poem, even if one is writing in one of those tricky old forms that the poets of the latter 19th century were fond of. It seems to me that that the use of form is a way simply of augmenting the emphases of what one is saying. Rhymes are there for one reason, because rhyming words are or should be important words. They should be words which can be heard with a special emphasis because of the chiming of sounds. And what I always tell students when they ask me about meter is that the use of any meter or of any form like the sonnet form is to be violated in a meaningful way. The great users of our basic meter, the iambic pentameter, people like Milton, just tear the hell out of the line. They're not being tidy about it. And the most boring poems are poems which, for no reason at all, are metronomic. So for me, meter and rhyme and traditional forms are all means to saying what one wants to say with more power and definition.
One poem that illustrates Wilbur's use of form to empower its meaning is Trismegistus. I asked him to read it to us.
Yes, that's one of my most recent poems. And I think I've had a lot of reaction to that, more than usual. And partly I think it's because it is one of my best poems, also because it's on a challenging topic and approaches it from an odd angle.
And for those of our listeners who don't know to whom it refers, tell us who Hermes Trismegistus was.
Well, Hermes Trismegistus is someone, perhaps he never existed. Chances are he never existed, and I shan't go into all the lies which were told about him. But he was an important name in the Hermetic movement of the early Christian era. And our best sense of Hermes Trismegistus comes from Milton's Il Penseroso, where he refers to Hermes and indeed describes himself as summoning up the spirit of this ancient figure of Hermetic lore to contribute to his ponderings.
And as I remember also, he was said to have been a melding of the god Hermes and the Egyptian god Thoth, and that he wrote some 35,000 books.
Well, yes, or somebody wrote a lot of things and attributed them to this man who did or did not exist. But there are certain central ideas associated with Hermes, which Milton invokes in his Il Penseroso. Well, shall I read this poem?
Please do.
It begins with a quotation from the great lament of Hermes. And I'm indebted for these words to Francis Yates, who quoted them first. "Oh, Egypt, Egypt, so the great lament of thrice great Hermes went. Nothing of thy religion shall remain save fables which thy children shall disdain. His grieving eye foresaw the world's bright fabric overthrown, which married star to stone and charged all things with awe. And what in that dismantled world could be more fabulous than he? Had he existed, was he but a name tacked on to forgeries which pressed the claim of every ancient quack, that one could from a smoky cell, by talisman or spell, coerce the zodiac? Still, still, we summon him at midnight hour to Milton's pensive tower, and hear him tell again how, then and now, creation is a house of mirrors, how each herb that sips the dew dazzles the eye with many small reflections of the all, which, after all, is true."
I think that's a marvelous example of how rhyme enhances the power of the poem. I'm just curious, why do you feel that it is your best poem?
I think that it does use the resources of meter and rhyme in support of its ideas, and that it does so easily and with obvious pertinence. I think that if I wanted to see any poem of mine in the light of Robert Frost's statement, which you quoted just now, I think it might be Trismegistus. It gets a lot of emphasis and pertinent echo out of rhyming, and all that seems utterly natural.
Poet Richard Wilbur. Stay tuned for more of our conversation after the break. You're listening to WMUA 91.1 FM in Amherst. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're spending the hour with the great American poet Richard Wilbur. Among his many honors is the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry, twice, and he was named Poet Laureate of the United States in 1987. Wilbur spoke with me and guest co-host Christian McEwen at his home in Cummington, Massachusetts, in June of this year.
Which poets do you yourself read for pleasure? Do you tend to go back to people, to the great ancestors like Milton, or whom among your contemporaries do you find yourself returning to?
Well, there are a good many of my contemporaries whom I read with pleasure. And when I say my contemporaries, of course, I'm speaking of a number of people who have died. But, for example, I never tire of reading Elizabeth Bishop. The precision of her eye, the quiet wit with which she writes, Elizabeth would be one of the poets I have known and read, to whom I happily return. I do return very often to John Milton, and that's not altogether surprising, because I found myself teaching him once again at Amherst last year. But I would go back to Milton whether I were teaching him or not. And I noticed that I don't spoil him for myself by talking about him to students.
You also have been instrumental in fostering the publication of some of others' great poets of our time, including Stanley Kunitz, and I think you were also a supporter of Donald Hall. Could you talk a bit about the connections that poets make with each other and the mutual support? It does seem that there's more of that in poetry than in other literary genres.
Well, there probably is, because even though there have been considerable changes in the poetry scene since I entered it, the poetry reading, for example, is now a fairly popular form of concert. And I think that when I was a kid, there were very few poetry readings to be had, even in university towns. And as for people barnstorming, the only barnstormers I can think of from those days were Robert Frost and Carl Sandburg sometimes, and of course Vachel Lindsay. They traveled the country giving successful performances, but it was on the whole an uncommon form of concert. One could talk also about the sales of poetry books, which have indeed increased. And a new volume of poetry, which is favorably reviewed, is likely to please the publisher by its number of sales.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with poet Richard Wilbur. I asked him to tell us what it was about Stanley Kunitz's work that had drawn Wilbur to support it in helping Kunitz gain a larger audience.
Stanley Kunitz was a very fine poet before I ever met him, and I had read him with pleasure from the treasured volumes of certain friends. He had his admirers, but it just happened that I was able to be useful to him. The first time I went to see him in New York City, Stanley was a little distressed because no publisher seemed to want to do the kind of new and selected that he had in mind. And I thought that was perfect nonsense on the part of these publishers. So I sent off a postcard at once to my friend Wendy Morrison, who was then an editor at Little Brown, and said, why don't you get in touch right away with Stanley Kunitz, ask him to send you a manuscript. If he does, you'll want to publish it, and it will win the Pulitzer Prize. And all of that happened. And I was delighted to be useful to Stanley in that way. And lots of poets have been useful to other poets, as you were saying. It is, I suppose, a competitive world, but it's a world in which many people rise above competition and are of use to each other.
Is there something about poetry that actually brings out the best in us?
Is there something that brings out the best? I'm not sure. I'm not sure that it brings out the best in us. I think I'd have to go off and ponder that question for a while.
I was thinking both as a reader as well as a poet. I mean, from the stance of the reader as well as a poet.
I think poetry does a lot of things for us. I have a little poem called A Barred Owl in which I say that that one thing poetry does is to teach us to say the names of what we dread, what we fear. Any kind of articulateness is emboldening to the human creature. And that's one job that poetry does, I think. As Thomas Hardy said, to have a look at the worst, to specify what is dreadful, is in some degree to disarm those things.
Do you have that poem at hand? Could you read that to us?
Yes. This is the poem we were speaking of. It's called A Barred Owl. And when I read this to an audience, I always remind them that a good many of them will already understand that what the barred owl says when it cries out in the woods at night is, "Who cooks for you?" A barred owl. The warping night air having brought the boom of an owl's voice into her darkened room. We tell the wakened child that all she heard was an odd question from a forest bird, asking of us, if rightly listened to, who cooks for you, and then who cooks for you? Words which can make our terrors bravely clear can also thus domesticate a fear and send a small child back to sleep at night, not listening for the sound of stealthy flight or dreaming of some small thing in a claw borne up to some dark branch and eaten raw. There was a teacher in the Philadelphia area who told me that one of her students had said, "Oh, a barred owl, that's that poem which begins like a lullaby and ends like a nightmare." and it does. But I think, as I said, that one of the functions of poetry is to make our terrors clear and so disarm them a little. The worst thing of all is nameless dread, isn't it?
Yeah, and yet, ironically, what just came to mind was one of your poems of that I have read of greatest joy. I think it's probably one of your most well-known poems, with the laundry, the angels. What is the name of that poem again?
Well, it has a long name. Love calls us to the things of this world. I thought that I took that title directly out of the Confessions of St. Augustine, a number of fathers at Notre Dame have not been able to find it there verbatim. But actually, not long ago, I was looking into Augustine again, and that title is the gist of some things he is saying in the very earliest pages.
In the earliest pages of which?
Of his Confessions, yes.
So, would you read that poem for us?
Sure. Some poets get very tired of their most popular poems. And I've heard that it was an agony for Mr. Yeats to have to read that poem about the Isle of Innisfree yet again. Though I can understand that in his case, because the Innisfree poem is not in the style to which he later came, I think. It may be a charming poem, but it's not the way he was being interesting in his latter years. Let's see if I can find that blasted poem.
Do you also feel weary when asked to read this poem?
I don't feel at all weary of this one because I like it, and I'd be happy to have written it yesterday. Sometimes I find it useful to the audience, when I'm about to read this poem, to tell them that it was written in Rome. And perhaps it's a poem that refers to nuns at one point, and there are more nuns in the street in Rome than in Schenectady, for example. But also, I think that much of America had given up drying laundry in the air when urban Italy was still persisting in it. I don't know how it is right now. I don't know how many laundry lines you could expect to see looking at a Roman apartment house. But when I was there in 1956 or so, one woke up in our apartment house of a Monday morning, and our neighbor's laundry was being yanked across the window on a system of ropes and pulleys. Love calls us to the things of this world. The eyes open to a cry of pulleys and spirited from sleep, the astounded soul hangs for a moment, bodiless and simple as false dawn. Outside the open window, the morning air is all awash with angels. Some are in bedsheets, some are in blouses, some are in smocks, but truly there they are. Now they are rising together in calm swells of halcyon feeling, filling whatever they wear with the deep joy of their impersonal breathing. Now they are flying in place, conveying the terrible speed of their omnipresence, moving and staying like white water. And now of a sudden they swoon down into so rapt a quiet that nobody seems to be there. The soul shrinks from all that it is about to remember, from the punctual rape of every blessed day, and cries, "Oh, let there be nothing on earth but laundry, nothing but rosy hands in the rising steam, and clear dances done in the sight of heaven." Yet, as the sun acknowledges with a warm look the world's hunks and colors, the soul descends once more in bitter love to accept the waking body, saying now in a changed voice as the man yawns and rises, "Bring them down from their ruddy gallows. Let there be clean linen for the backs of thieves. Let lovers go fresh and sweet to be undone, and the heaviest nuns walk in a pure floating of dark habits, keeping their difficult balance."
I just have to ask about a couple of words. And, you know, I feel awkward asking a poet about words because a poem is about, ironically so, because a poem is an entirety. It's a whole thing. But words are pivots, and there is a word that's a pivot in there that really struck me when I read that, and it was the word rape. It just comes so suddenly, and it's like a turning. You wrote it a long time ago, but I wonder if you could, do you remember choosing that word and why that word?
Punctual rape of every blessed day. I suppose that if I had said the punctual violation of every blessed day, it would have seemed less jarring, though of course that's what I mean. Every day begins potentially blessed, and then we louse it up. I'm not sure that for me it's one of the obtrusively shocking words in the poem, but I think I've answered your question, haven't I?
Yes, you have. And then the other word that I actually just loved because it was so completely unexpected was hunk.
Hunk, yes. That word absolutely delights me in this poem. I wanted very much to have it there because at that point the poem is coming down off it. There's no more disembodied spirituality in it. It's coming down to come to terms with the material, the physical, and the everyday. And hunk does a lot of that in one word.
I have two little questions. I have a huge fondness for your poem, A Summer Morning, perhaps because I grew up in that rather old-fashioned ambience myself. I grew up in Scotland, in the country. And I wondered whether there was a particular story that gave rise to that poem.
A Summer Morning, that's about the young people coming home in the morning and bumping their fender against the gate.
Yeah, the servants are in charge of the place because the young couple have not yet descended to their estate.
I don't think I knew any particular pair of dissolute young people when I was visiting in England. Of course, this scene could be in various parts of America as well, and I think this is a poem that drew in a general way on my experience, but did not have original persons in mind. I grew up on a place which we didn't own, in which there were gardeners everywhere, and so it didn't seem at all odd to me that there should be a gardener at the end of this, at the end of this poem. And when I was a kid, even though we were going through the Depression, everybody had servants. So I think that there's nothing specially odd in this poem, and certainly there's no particular story behind it. A summer morning. Her young employers, having got in late from seeing friends in town and scraped the right front fender on the gate, will not, the cook expects, be coming down. She makes a quiet breakfast for herself. The coffee pot is bright, the jelly where it should be on the shelf. She breaks an egg into the morning light, then, with the bread knife lifted, stands and hears the sweet, efficient sounds of thrush and catbird, where, in the terraced backward of the grounds, a gardener works before the heat of day. He straightens for a view of the big house ascending stony gray out of his beds, mosaic with the dew. His young employers having got in late, he and the cook alone receive the morning on their old estate, possessing what the owners can but own.
Thank you so much for reading that. I delight in its specificity and in that very precise joyousness that it celebrates. It's lovely how you've done that. So I had one last question. There's a couplet in yet another of your older poems, the one called At Year's End, which was written way back in 1949. And you speak there of men expecting yet another son to do the shapely thing they have not done. And I wondered for yourself, you have done so many shapely things. Do you feel that you have done what you came here to do, or are there yet more mountains that you see in the, on the distance that you want to climb?
I don't think I think farther ahead than the next possible poem, but I should be very sorry if I didn't find that there was still some impetus, some inclination to write another poem. I don't know what I might next translate. That's been part of my general impetus, and of late I've been translating Corneille. I've published one of his plays, a wonderful thing called The Theatre of the Illusion, a couple of years ago, and I'm about to publish two more plays of his, Le Cid and The Liar. I don't know where I'm going from there. A friend tells me I'd better do Corneille's Nicomède, but I'm not really yet familiar with that play. Haven't been grabbed by it. Something will grab me. I'll probably want to do another translation. And it would be foolish, not for gloomy reasons, but it would be foolish in general to think beyond the next task. I hope for another poem. And I'd be pleased if some French text hooked me and made me translate it.
Well, Richard Wilbur, thank you so much for talking with us here in your lovely writing space.
You're very welcome.
As Christian and I made our way out with Wilbur, I noticed his hallway was lined with posters. One was of a painting by Andrew Wyeth with a poem by Wilbur beneath it. Tell us about this.
There was an outfit called Poetry on the Buses, I think, and I believe it was in Pittsburgh, and they wrote to me and said they were trying to get permission to reproduce something of Andrew Wyeth's, and they needed a little poem to go with it. And Wyeth had said, well, you may have it if Wilbur will do a poem. So I did this little poem.
And will you read it for us?
Beyond them, hill and field. Well, I should start with the title, Wyeth's Milk Cans. Beyond them, hill and field harden, and summer's easy wheel ruts lie congealed. What if these two bells tolled? They'd make the bark splintering music of pure cold.
That's great. Thanks, the two milk cans. Yeah. Just beyond the Wyeth poster, the wall was filled with playbills from the theater productions Wilbur had written the lyrics for. So this is a wall of your translations. We have Tartuffe.
Yes, mostly it is. I was involved in a musical. I did the lyrics for a musical with Hellman and Bernstein back there.
And I heard that was, they were two pretty strong personalities.
Very strong personalities. Well, I loved Lillian's personality. We had a great time together. Bernstein and I were friends too, but we had the inevitable squabbles that lyricists and composers have. But I was very admiring of him, and he was wonderfully full of energy. It was great to work with him.
And, I mean, it's just to read here, this is a poster. When was this, by the way?
I think it was 56.
So it's staged by the great Tyrone Guthrie, great, great director. These are names I remember from my childhood, actually.
Yes. Oh, he was a wonder, a very good director.
And Dorothy Parker, she also participated in the lyrics?
She's somewhat over-advertised here because... She tried out more or less as a lyricist of the show, and then she didn't get along with Bernstein, and she quit. And there are just a few lines of hers left in the final version of the show, but her name was so famous it seemed suitable to advertise in that manner.
It's about as big as Bernstein's. Well, that's wonderful. Thanks so much.
Well, great.
Poet Richard Wilbur. He taught for many years at Amherst College. Among his honors are the Wallace Stevens Award, the Frost Medal, and the Gold Medal for Poetry from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. You can read some of the poems he read today, as well as others, by going to writersvoice.net. We mentioned a list of nature words taken out of the Oxford English Dictionary for Children and the new words that took their place. You'll find those also on our website, writersvoice.net. Thanks to intern Janine Cooper for her assistance on today's show. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.